This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, happy Friday. Welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff, broadcasting across South Australia and Broken Hill. Commodity prices seem to be going from strength to strength, don't they? Prices have climbed by 15% since the end of March across most markets, as some countries have benefited from favourable weather conditions and the economic recovery from COVID-19.
Well, La Nina has been largely a blessing for many growers and irrigators, particularly here in Australia. In other parts of the world, it's been a major, major challenge.
Look at what that's meant for markets soon. But first, to shortages. Now, it's not just the fruit and vegetable farmers facing worker shortages at the moment. The South Australian Forest Products Association CEO Nathan Payne says he's hearing from members that there's a lack of drivers qualified to drive heavy trucks as well. He told Bridget Herman that processors in the southeast are running at maximum capacity and more drivers are needed.
COVID has caused, I guess, a demand surge for truck drivers. We're saying, I think it's a bit of an ageing industry in terms of, you know, if you look at the workforce, they're a bit older. We haven't necessarily had more young people coming in. And those that we have sometimes been lost off to the mines. But certainly what we have right now is a shortage of truck drivers, and it's being felt, I think, across the economy.
Has that been exacerbated by the state of the timber industry late last year when exports to China were essentially banned?
Yeah, look, I think late last year we did see that some truck drivers did make the move into other industries where there was potentially a bit more certainty around the future. The reality of 2021 is that it's actually boom times in the timber industry at the moment. If you look at the processes around Mount Gambier, they are running as hard as they can to meet the needs of consumers, and that's great news. But we do need truck drivers to be able to get logs out of the forest and to the mills, and then obviously from the mills to consumers, and that's a big challenge.
And is this shortage actually preventing the harvesters from going at 100% capacity?
As I understand it, not at this point in time. I mean, the processors are running at capacity, so it's really, you know, what we need to do is we need to make sure that we can address some of the structural challenges with regards to the people with a heavy vehicle licence moving to a multi-combination licence. And currently that's a time-based requirement that we think should be converted to a competency-based requirement. We know that there is some work being done with Department of Transport and Infrastructure at the moment, which is a really positive start with some pilots. And we've raised this with Minister Pizzoni, and I was really pleased with how he picked up and engaged with the issue and wanted to engage even further. So it's really positive that this is a challenge that has been identified, and hopefully we can work towards resolving it.
And what else did you bring up with the minister when you met with him?
Yeah, look, I mean, I guess the challenges in and around training and skills is a constant issue. It's a constant issue for most industries, really, but certainly when you talk about regional cities like Mount Gambier with smaller populations, they can become critical issues. So, you know, what we talked about with Minister Pizzoni was, you know, the need to make sure that there is a strong focus on skills and training. Again, really pleased with how he heard the message that we were sending. He was very keen to get down to Mount Gambier and meet with the industry at his earliest available opportunity, which is fantastic.
Has he done that yet?
No, we only met with him about a week and a half ago. So he had a scheduled visit down and indicated that he'd like to try and see whether he can get down earlier. As I said, I think it's a really positive meeting with the minister, and we look forward to continuing to work with them and the government going forward.
And if the labour shortage with truck drivers isn't currently stopping the harvesters from going at 100% capacity, how is it actually impacting them?
Yeah, it's across the entire, I guess, logistics chain. So if you've got all of your truck drivers driving logs out of the forest to the mills, you might not necessarily have as many truck drivers available to take the product from the mills to the consumers. So and what we know is that this is a problem that's across the economy. You know, it's amazing right now that there are many, you know, areas of labour shortage. And you know, we're hearing about it, whether it's in tradespeople or truckies. It is a challenge, and I think, you know, so some work around population growth will you know, significantly help alleviate that.
There's been a lot of talk in recent months about the home builder scheme and how wait times for building of houses is getting pushed out due to the demand. Is this particular shortage having any impact on that and causing consumers to wait longer?
Look, that's not happening at this point in time. The issue with timber shortages that have been discussed is largely in and around the lack of imports coming into Australia. So historically, we've some builders have imported timber from overseas, and those imports haven't been available. So our processors are doing a fantastic job of running as hard as they can to meet as much of the demand as possible. You know, recognising that the home builder brought forward a wave, almost a tsunami of demand. I think it was about 13,000 home builder applications in a state that normally builds 8,000 dwellings a year. So, you know, it's a big hit. It's a big demand hit. We're working as hard as we can to make sure that consumers can be confident that they'll have timber on there to build their homes with.
SAFPA CEO Nathan Payne speaking to Bridget Herman there about the shortage of heavy truck drivers in the southeast and across the state, it seems, at the moment. Now to the Murray-Darling Basin, where water ministers met yesterday to try and sort out some of the sticking points to delivering the 605 gigalitres that are needed to come via the sustainable diversion limit adjustment measured by 2024. So these are the projects that are going to give back some water to the environment. And it was a relatively uneventful meeting as far as these meetings go, but there's still a big question mark over some of the big projects like the Menindee Lakes reconfiguration. South Australia's Water Minister David Spears was there. Minister Spears, was there anything resolved at this MINCO meeting?
This meeting was fairly administrative in nature. It was an out-of-station meeting, so there wasn't a great deal on the agenda. But as you mentioned, we were digging into the 605 SIDLAM projects, the 605 gigalitre that have been proposed and are well underway. There has recently been a report undertaken by an independent organisation called INDEC, INDEC, and they've revealed that 75% of the 605 gigalitres is actually on track to be delivered. Now, is 75% enough? No, it's not, but it's actually quite heartening because some of these projects have struggled along the way, so I'm pleased to see that we are well on track to get the vast majority of these projects delivered. And then we took a look at some of the projects that have proven to be a bit harder to get done and are experiencing some challenges. That includes the Menindee Lakes project and one at Yanco as well. Both of these projects need some intervention, and so we had a good conversation with New South Wales. A high level of collaboration between the states in this meeting. That hasn't always been the case in the past, as I'm sure your listeners would be well aware, but we had some good conversations about how those projects could be rescoped and potentially supported by the Commonwealth to ensure that we do get those projects online, and the New South Wales government is going to spend the next couple of months really working with the federal government to make sure that those projects can be scoped up effectively.
Given it's taken years to get to this point, particularly with those big projects like you mentioned there, Menindee Lakes and Yanco, do you think it's going to be possible to rescope these projects in a way that will be amenable to the local community?
Look, it is a big challenge, there's no doubt about that. But the New South Wales government have been working on what the tweaking of these projects would look like, the refinement of them to ensure they are more amenable to the local community. I think one thing we've got to bear in mind is there has been very significant rain in that part of the basin, life-giving rain, both for the environment but also importantly for the economic viability of those regions. We've got huge inflows into the storages at Medindie Lakes at the moment, and that is taking a lot of the emotional pressure out of the debate, and so we are able to have those very thorough, very detailed discussions and engagement opportunities with the communities. I understand there are some pretty challenging Aboriginal concerns in terms of sacred sites and middens and things like that, which could have been impacted under the early plans for the Menindee Lakes project. So that is something that has to be carefully considered and worked through. The New South Wales government seem to be up for this challenge. There is more work happening on these projects, both Menindee Lakes, Yanco and others, than I have seen during my 3 years as the minister. And so I think there is goodwill and there is appetite amongst all states, but particularly New South Wales and their partnership with the Commonwealth to get this done.
With the water going into Menindee Lakes, it's expected that the governing of the lakes will move from the New South Wales government to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority once it reaches more than 680 gigalitres in the lakes. And last time this happened, in 2017, there was a big release of water from Menindee Lakes to facilitate water needs downstream. Does South Australia have any plans to draw on that water or put in a request for environmental or irrigator use?
South Australia doesn't have any requests in. We don't expect to see any releases from the lakes to facilitate downstream irrigation or supply at this stage. That is something we'll be working through with the authority and with the other states. And I'll be cautioning the Murray-Darling Basin Authority to manage any outflows in the coming months or year very carefully.
The National Irrigators Council has raised concerns about the level of accountability and transparency from these meetings and are calling for MINCO to publish their meeting dates and agendas as well as release meeting minutes. Will MINCO do that?
Well, that wasn't discussed at the Ministerial Council. I think we're quite a transparent body. I don't think there was any secret when the meeting was being held. We publish a communique, which is essentially a record of what occurred and the decisions that were made, albeit there weren't many in the most recent meeting, but the papers, I understand, are available, and there is plenty of opportunity for the Irrigators Council to have their say to stakeholder ministers. I think sometimes these organisations feel they have to have a whinge in order to justify their existence. They need to just get on with it and work with us.
Well, thank you for your time today, Minister.
No problem at all. Thank you, Cassie.
South Australia's Water Minister, David Spears. I've had a text in relating to the truck driver shortage, saying over-policing targeting truck drivers has sent drivers to the mines. Thanks for your text. You can text me on 0467 922 891 or you can call 1300 222 891. It is coming up to 18 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
A Port Wakefield farmer says a proposed rate plan could mean some farmers leave the area. Wakefield Regional Council, north of Adelaide, is considering encouraging business development by lowering commercial rates over 10 years. However, that could come at a cost to farmers, with a proposal to increase rates from 74 to 90% in the same period. Owen farmer Andrew Parker says that could put an unfair burden on primary producers.
At the moment, rural landowners are contributing around 62%. Of council's annual revenue already. Now, that's fine, but if the council goes ahead with one of the scenarios they've come up with, it will mean a lot higher increase for farmers than just a percentage, because at the moment, farm production land is going up considerably faster than the CPI, and the income generated from that land has not changed at all. So asset rich, cash poor, as that saying goes.
So are you saying that the increase is disproportional to the income that's being made on those properties?
Yes. Yeah, we'll be. And farmers do generate a lot of income for the council, and without that, the council would struggle to run, and I'm well aware of that. But perhaps the council needs to look towards federal money and grants and stuff instead of turning off to the problem producers all the time, and eventually they're just going to cause more farmers to leave the land because they won't be able to afford to pay their rates. But it's a very complicated rating system for all council regions across the state. They're all different.
So do you think this increase from 74% to 90% is justifiable?
No. No, I think that would be very, very unfair. I think that would really have a big impact on the amount of rates that farmers are paying.
You made a point before that about the rates are going up, but in terms of income on those properties is not changing. Can you explain that a little bit more?
The rates are worked out as a percentage of the value of your land. So if my land 10 years ago was worth about $1,000 an acre and now it's worth $5,000 or $6,000 an acre, then obviously the rating is going to be hugely more than it was 10 years ago. And that's one of the reasons why they use that percentage to try and make it a bit fairer, because they are well aware that primary production land is going up quite rapidly, and it's compared to, say, a house or a business in the local town. I think it's time we headed towards the state and federal governments to actually fund rural councils more. Wakefield Regional Council has massive road infrastructure, and to expect the farmers to be able to manage that or help pay for all of that is just crazy. And they have been let go, and now they have actually increased their spend on roads, and now they need to find some way of paying for it. But I don't think any off to the farmer is the way to go.
Owen farmer Andrew Parker speaking to Gillian Area. And in a statement, Wakefield Regional Council CEO Andrew McDonald said the development of an effective and equitable rating policy will require a number of member workshops to carefully consider community feedback, explore various scenarios and understand the impact on ratepayers prior to drafting a policy for the community's consideration. This is one of the most important policies of council, and therefore sufficient time must be provided to ensure all opportunities and options are carefully explored. So still more to come in that space. Before we get to the weather, you might have noticed that agricultural commodities have reached price levels not seen for a decade, according to Rabobank's latest research. Prices have climbed by 15% since the end of March across most markets. Some countries benefit from these favourable weather conditions and the economic recovery of COVID-19. Senior commodity analyst Charlie Clack says although China's direct trade relationship with Australia is grim, the nation's hunger to import commodities from other countries has contributed to the global price jump.
We're seeing some really, really strong global prices for agri-commodities. And so, yeah, really historically high, and a number of reasons behind that.
Can you talk us through some of those key indicators and reasons why these prices have climbed so high?
So to begin with, I think we need to emphasise, you know, the big factor for all agri-commodities every year, and that's been weather. There's been a huge amount of weather risk entering into the market at the moment. While La Nina has been largely a blessing for many growers and irrigators, particularly here in Australia, we've seen some nice moisture. Of course, you know, soil moisture now, you know, pretty much full in terms of the profile. You know, some on-farm dams nice and full as well. It's been a real blessing here. In other parts of the world, it's been a major, major challenge. And so when we look at those big heavyweights when it comes to agri-commodity exports, we're looking at the US, we're looking at Brazil in particular, and those guys are, you know, facing some pretty serious dryness. And so, you know, that all comes back to actually reducing kind of what is available to the world. Add on top of that, fairly active speculative force at the moment. There's a lot of investors out there looking for a potential hedge against US dollar inflation, and agri-commodities provides, you know, a compromise there. You know, some of those safe havens, like the likes of gold or perhaps, you know, real estate. In a COVID world, well, they've either become very expensive or you know, not quite so easy to do business with. So, yeah, agri-commodities is providing quite a popular place to put your money if you're worried about US dollar inflation.
So what does all of this global movement mean for Australia?
For the Australian market, of course, it is pretty positive. You know, not only have we seen some really positive signs from the weather in terms of La Nina providing us that moisture, but of course, you know, many of these global prices form a benchmark for the Aussie price received at the farm gate. Now, you know, when we look at the, perhaps, you know, say the grain price or so, it's not a perfect correlation. inflation. Of course, we take into account basis here as well. And, you know, we're looking at a relatively positive signs of production, which, of course, high supply in the region will put pressure on the basis. But the overall aspect, given that we are a major exporting nation for many different commodities across cereals, sugar, cotton, etc., this forms a benchmark. So it does provide some really strong prices and a good outlook, I guess, for our growers when it comes to margin.
Rabobank Senior Commodity Analyst Charlie Clack speaking with Jane McNaughton there about this huge jump that's been seen across the globe when it comes to commodity prices. It was probably something difficult to believe this time last year when COVID was really just taking hold and people didn't know where it was going, but it's had all sorts of effects on commodities across the globe. We'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now, where I'm joined by Senior Forecaster Vince Rollins. Good afternoon, Vince.
Hello, Cassie.
So it's been a fairly quiet week. What's coming up for the weekend weather-wise?
Yeah, look, there's a bit of a change coming across over the weekend. So another pretty warm day today, seeing those northerly winds just pick up a little bit, particularly over western parts. So you're probably likely to see temperatures above average today. But we do have a front moving across the south and west of the state tomorrow. So again, we'll see quite fresh to strong northerly winds ahead of that front, but a milder southerly change coming in behind it. And those winds are likely to drive a little bit of raised dust over parts of Eyre Peninsula and central and eastern districts, and we will see a bit of an increase in fire dangers. But as I mentioned yesterday, just looking at very highs across several districts at this stage. Now, there's not a lot of rainfall with it. We're likely to see a little bit of shower activity about the far southeast, and there is a chance of some mid-level thunderstorms just about the southern parts of Kangaroo Island and perhaps the lower southeast coast, but not expecting too much rainfall out of those. But the front continues to move eastwards during Sunday, so we could see a little bit of fog just over the agricultural area, just associated with the winds easing off behind that system, and likely to see some shower activity continuing about the lower southeast with a possible early morning thunderstorm. Now, we're not really expecting too much rainfall across the state until we get into the Monday, Tuesday period and beyond that. So looks like on Monday we will see a bit of a mid-level band developing over parts of the northern agricultural area and southern pastoral districts, producing a little bit of rainfall up through those regions. And then further south we will see showers over mainly the southern agricultural area just due to an onshore airstream. So we will see some shower activity basically south of Woomera on Monday. That does continue on Tuesday, maybe pushing just a little bit further north. But a lot of the rainfall on Tuesday and even sort of late on Monday is associated with a low pressure system. And where that develops and how much it develops is really going to drive the rainfall totals. So I spoke about the rainfall totals yesterday. There is a chance that some locations could see a little bit more, but as I said, it's totally dependent on the movement of this low. So we'll be watching that pretty closely over the weekend and early next week. As we head into the middle of next week and then through to the weekend, we are expecting showers to continue over the agricultural areas and southern pastoral districts. Not expecting really big totals, but obviously, you know, we'll see some rainfall figures through that period. And it looks like maybe next Friday could be the peak of the days with a bit more rainfall expected on that day. So, yeah, looks like tomorrow, pretty warm day across the state to start with before that change comes through. A little bit of dust. And then we'll focus on the rainfall as we head into Monday and Tuesday next week. So at this stage, I'm still thinking, you know, around the 2 millimetres or thereabouts for the northern agricultural area and southern pastoral districts. A few places might get a little bit more. And then with the southern agricultural area, there's indications it generally will be in the 2 to 5 millimetre range, but there's probably some locations in there. And at this stage, yeah, it's still a little bit unknown that'll get in that 5 to 10 millimetre range. So we'll be looking at that pretty closely. So hopefully we do see some good reasonable rainfall totals over parts of the agricultural area over the next week, but yeah, it's still a little bit up in the air at this stage.
as to how much will come through.
That's
hopefully
right.
It's the start of the autumn break and winter rainfall. So we'll watch it closely. Thanks so much for that, Vince.
No worries, Cassie.
That's Vince Rollins from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking there. And in the far west of New South Wales, the Upper Western, it's going to be mostly sunny overnight. It's going to get down to 10 to 15 degrees. But the daytime temperatures will be a balmy mid to high 20s. The Lower Western, partly cloudy. Overnight temperatures there are going to fall to between 9 to 13 degrees. But the daytime temperatures will reach the mid to high 20s there as well. So relatively calm, cool, nice temperatures in the far west of New South Wales. We've got more to come on Bravo Apples. That's coming up. It's almost 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hi, it's great to have your company this Friday afternoon. The federal budget is a few weeks away and a think tank has put forward the idea that the fuel tax credit scheme should be phased out. Now, this is popular with farmers, but is it a handbrake on developing alternatives? I'll get into that discussion next. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. You can text me on 0467922891 or phone 1300 222 891. Also, pretty new Marin farmers in South Australia have taken out a big award at the annual Delicious Produce Awards.
Everyone seems to love it. Everyone that we have spoken to that has tried them has said that it's now their crustacean of choice, which is nice.
They're pretty tasty. Interested to hear how they took out that gong when they've only been in business for about a year. It's a great story there. But first we'll find out what's making news with Wendy Glemacek. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, the state government has announced a major shake-up of South Australia's homelessness services that will see five new alliances formed. Adelaide South, Adelaide North, Country South, Country North and Domestic and Family Violence are now set to deliver crisis support. The Hutt Street Centre and Catherine House for Homeless Women are among crucial crisis services that were not part of a successful tender. The federal opposition says a travel loophole that allowed Australians to fly back from India shows that the government has created a mess. The Prime Minister has vowed to take further action after it emerged that a loophole was allowing Australians to travel back from India through Qatar. Health authorities say there's no evidence so far to link the AstraZeneca vaccine to two deaths in New South Wales. Both men suffered blood clots and died in hospital. Professor John Skerritt from the Therapeutic Goods Administration says there have been six cases linked to blood clots out of a million doses. And official figures show the US economy grew at an annual rate of 6.4% in the first 3 months of this year. The growth coincides with the early stages of that country's vaccination program. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. A report released by think tank the Australia Institute that looks at the cost of fossil fuel subsidies in state and federal budgets has prompted calls for measures such as the fuel tax credit scheme to be phased out. The group says that the scheme, which costs Australia $7.84 billion in the federal budget, should go. Now, this is obviously just weeks out from the federal budget being released, but farmers say it's not a subsidy but a rebate on the cost, and the cost of production would skyrocket without it. But Australia Institute researcher Rod Campbell says pulling the fuel rebate would drive new innovation in agriculture.
Let's first put this in context. This is a rebate that goes to major users of fossil fuel. It accrues largely, the largest beneficiaries are the mining industry, particularly the coal industry, which gains a benefit of a bit over $1 billion a year. And the whole cost of the fuel tax rebate is about $7.8 billion a year, roughly the amount that we spend on the army. So this is a big ticket item in the budget. And the real problem is that it takes away or reduces the incentive to use less fossil fuel. So
what would you like to see happen? So you're wanting in the next budget the start of that to be phased out?
Yeah, I think it would be good to, I think we need to be phasing out fossil fuel subsidies, and this is Australia's biggest. And so obviously with such a significant change, there'd be a fair bit of politics around it. And I think basically from an economics point of view, if you want to support industries that's fine. There's a lot of good reasons why we might want to subsidise agriculture, and there's even good reasons why we might want to subsidise parts of the mining industry.
So I guess from an agricultural standpoint, a farmer would say they'd refute, I guess, the use of the term subsidy. The other point that I guess farmers would make is that at the moment there's no credible alternative to diesel. So really it would mean significantly higher costs in the short term. So what do you see as the alternative?
Yeah, so an alternative could be to keep making cash payments to recipients of the fuel tax rebate, perhaps based on the rebates they've received in the past, but to de-link it from fuel use. So in accounting terms, you're still just as well off, but now you've got a much bigger incentive to use less fuel, use biofuel, go electric, look at that new technology, look at more efficient fuel use. From an economics point of view and from a climate point of view, that's what should be done.
If you de-link that rebate then from some kind of incentive or payment system, does that then become virtue signalling? Because ultimately the outcome is going to be a similar one. Farmers going to keep still buying diesel because there are no alternatives right now.
Yeah, but again, you know, I'm an economist and I'll have to drag it back to economics. People keep buying diesel, but if it's costing them more, then they'll look into using less and they'll invest in things that use less. And if we're providing them with assistance to do so, that means in accounting terms, everyone's still better off. I mean, whether or not you see it as virtue signalling or good policy, you know, I think just it's a matter of perception. I mean, this isn't about virtue signalling. It's about trying to reduce the incentives to use fossil fuels that cost budgets money.
Australia Institute researcher Rod Campbell. So what do farmers think? Tony Seabrook is the president of the Pastoralists and Graziers Association. He says cutting the rebate would deliver a massive blow to the industry's competitiveness.
You'll achieve nothing by giving an industry like agriculture a belting. There will be a lot of other areas where alternative fuels will be far more applicable. When you've got a 400 or 500 horsepower four-wheel drive tractor out in the paddock planting a crop, there are no alternatives at the moment. When an economic and cheaper system fuel comes into play, then it may be an option. But at the moment, to advocate the removal of this exemption is lunacy.
Would increasing the price, though, be the incentive that industry needs to move towards some of these different options?
Increasing the price will just decrease our competitiveness. We've lost so much of our manufacturing across the board in this country over the last 30, 40 years because it ceased to be competitive. The last thing in the world we need now is to give agriculture, one of the few competitive industries we've got, any sort of a financial hiding. And to do this would amount to exactly that. And I've no doubt that these people are also gunning for the miners because there's a lot of diesel being used in mining. And you know, the stupidity and short-sightedness of this sort of latte group of people sitting in the cities of Melbourne thinking that the problems can be easily solved, it is just short-sighted and will not bring about the result they might be hoping for.
PGA President Tony Seabrook. Tony Wood is the Director of Energy and Climate Change at the Grattan Institute. He doesn't think the government or the opposition will remove the rebate for fear of constituent backlash.
Well, it does what it, like most of these things, it does what it was designed to do, which was basically to say, look, the fuel tax is at least partly to be paid for building and maintaining our road system. People who don't use the road system, such as miners and farmers, shouldn't therefore pay it. Now, that was put in place a long time ago, and like most taxes of the sort, we say we're raising money from people to spend it on this. The connection between raising the money and the spending of the money is probably no longer there, and pretty much the money that the government collects from fuel tax goes into general revenue, and it could be bigger or smaller. What we've got is a situation in which people who use diesel fuel particularly in an off-road situation are being given an advantage to reduce their costs. Like a lot of taxes, anything that reduces costs for somebody, one could argue, is a penalty on somebody else. But that's a very that could be a highly emotive position to take. But I think it's doing what it was intended to do. The question is it really something that we should be reviewing into the future?
What's your interpretation of, I mean, the Australia Institute, they've said, you know, but ultimately if they were to cease that rebate and prices were to go up, that automatically drives innovation. Is that a premise at face value that you accept?
Oh, not necessarily. I mean, if governments change the tax positions on any economic activity, whether it's increasing taxes or reducing taxes, those who are affected by that, either positively or negatively, do things differently. If governments put in place policies of various sorts, including climate policy, it gives companies and innovators and so forth the incentive to do things differently. And I absolutely agree, if this is what the Climate Institute, the Australian Institute is arguing, that we should be putting in place climate policies to give all economic activities incentives to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, absolutely. And would it mean that if a miner, for example, in regional Australia was no longer getting the fuel tax rebate for its diesel usage, it might then have a greater incentive to put in place solar energy with battery storage rather than to use diesel? The answer is almost certainly yes, but we already know that many of those companies are doing that anyway. So I think the connection, there is a logical connection, but I don't think it's as strong as the Australian Institute would suggest.
Do you think that there's room to differentiate, say, the big end of town in terms of the mining industry from your mum and dad farmer and the impact of that and the ability to reinvest?
Well, I think there is. The government needs, as we are grappling with the challenge of addressing climate change, then all the areas of our economy that produce greenhouse gas emissions ultimately will be caught up in that. Whether they're miners who are using diesel, whether they produce fugitive emissions from what they extract from the earth, such as natural gas or coal or whatever, or whether they're farmers whose farming agricultural practices, including livestock, produce greenhouse gas emissions, all of those are going to have to be addressed. And providing the right carrots and sticks or incentives and penalties to produce that is the right answer. Now, I think you've got to start there and say, okay, what's the best way to introduce a fair system of ensuring that all greenhouse gas emissions are reduced over the next couple of decades? In that process, you might say, well, one way we might want to do that is adjust some of the taxes we already collect or introduce new taxes, in which case maybe the fuel tax would arise. But I think you've got to think about this problem that way around rather than start off by saying, oh, the fuel tax rebate is bad for the environment and therefore should be got rid of. I think it's just a lot. I mean, it could be the answer, but I think it's asking the wrong question.
Ultimately, do you think this is just going to stay in the too hard basket ahead of the next federal election?
Look, I think the issue of the fuel tax rebate has been around for a long time, and at various times people have suggested that it should be considered to be an unfair tax, partly for the reasons the Australia Institute has indicated in their report. In almost in every case, government, whoever was in government, has decided it's just too hard. Unwinding some of these taxes is politically very difficult, purely from that political position. And you've got, you know, constituents here who would be pretty unhappy about it. So if you were doing an overall, you know, root and branch review of tax, you might think about these sort of taxation arrangements. But I think the idea that in relation to climate policy or even budget repair, that the government was going to embrace removing the rebate on fuel tax, I think that would be, I'd be very surprised if the government or even the federal Labor were about to embrace that sort of approach. Well, we'll see. The Labor could decide to do it. The government could decide to do it. But I'd be surprised if, given the history of what has happened in the past.
The Grattan Institute's Energy and Climate Change Program Director, Tony Wood, ending that report from Jessica Hayes. And a few texts reinforcing the point that this fuel excise was put on to upkeep the roads. Farmers and miners don't wear out their roads in their paddocks and mines. That's from Jack. A similar point is being made from Jay, from Claire, saying it has never been a subsidy. It is a rebate from another texter I don't have the name for, sorry. It's never been a subsidy. It's a rebate off the road tax portion of the fuel that we first have to pay for, which we can then claim back for fuel that is used. But in the Clare Valley, there's a texter saying that people are driving in V8 diesel four-wheel drives as a sole trader. I don't get the subsidy for my diesel fuel. ute. So thanks for your texts there. Do keep them coming. You can text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Now, a year ago, you met Marin farmers Aston Reed and Ben Underdown on this program, and they told themselves at that time that one day they would win a Delicious Magazine Produce Award. They'd just started out, and they thought it would take years to have their names on that list, but this year they are a state winner in the C section alongside some other great products around South Australia. Ms. Reed says it's a huge honour. She couldn't believe it when she found out.
We were so excited, couldn't wipe the smile off our face. I was actually in Mount Gambier at the time, and so I called Ben, and yeah, we had a great chat and then went off and celebrated.
And is it something like you'd think that you would have had so early into what you were starting with the Marin?
No, not at all. When we started it, we launched the business about a year ago, and Delicious were just announcing the winners of the awards for 2020, and we were looking at them and saying, that's our goal. One day we're going to win a Delicious Award, thinking, you know, this is many years down the track. And then we got a message from a chef from the Slopian Inn asking if she could try some Marin, and then she nominated us for an award. So we filled out the application, and then we got an email saying we were a finalist. So we were really excited about that, and we sent off some Marin to the state judges, and then found out that we won.
How is the Marin business going at the moment, Aston?
Yes, good. I mean, it's taken off. The marketing and everything has taken off, and we get that many inquiries about them. We don't have enough Marin and Yabbies to supply all the people that are after them, which is a good problem to have. We just need to keep breeding them up and keep growing our stock.
Is it mainly South Australian chefs and buyers, or interstate as well?
No, Sydney and Melbourne and Adelaide. Mostly.
And what have you been doing in the past sort of 12 months since we caught up last time in regards to marketing and getting your product out there?
Well, we've just continued on with our social media, really. That's all we've been doing. And then because we've been getting, obviously, more stock out to more restaurants, then they also do a bit of promotion through their menus and that. And so that's probably helped it grow as well.
And did you think it would get this big with the Marin?
No, not at all. It's been fantastic. We just can't believe how popular they are. So it's a good sign of, you know, things to come when we can keep growing up the population.
And what are the plans now? Where do you go from here?
So now we are going to start doing some testing and experimenting with breeding to see if we can start breeding up more stock that way. And then also just a lot of feeding and growing them as much as we can in the channels naturally.
Obviously around Coffin Bay, with the tourists coming to see, particularly the oysters is always popular, and the oyster tours there. Is that something that you would look at doing with Marin as well?
Yeah, we've started doing a lot of tours around the farm with Australian Coastal Safaris, which is a lot of fun. So people come and we walk them through the whole farm, and sometimes they'll stay and, you know, we can try some yabbies and sit around the fire and have a chat. We've also got like a big lunch on Saturday with Tasting Australia, which will be a lot of fun. Tasting Australia are bringing 80 people to Coffin Bay to go and try some oysters and do some cockling, and then they're going to come to the Marin Farm and have a chat with us and have a chat with the chef, and he'll cook them up over the fire in front of everyone, and they can all have a taste.
And have you been surprised with how people have taken on Marin, particularly, you know, your everyday consumer?
Yeah, everyone seems to love it. Everyone that we have spoken to that has tried them has said it's now their crustacean of choice, which is nice.
Aston Reed, who farms Marin with her partner Ben Underdown at Cuffin Bay, speaking to Brooke Neindorf. And there were some other, lots of winners from South Australia this year in the Delicious Awards. Other ones in the C section are Ozab, Clean Seas Seafood, Gazander Oysters, and Two Gulfs Crab. But there are lots of other sections as well. Now, I've had a caller in relation to the fuel rebate story. Anthony joins me. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. What I'm saying, that bloke talking about the fuel, wiping out the fuel subsidy, he wants to get a reality check and a bit of common sense. If we lose that rebate, well, we would expect to get a lot more for our produce, because it's going to cost us a lot more to produce it. The freight prices, everything else across the board will go up. So it's not subsidising us. It's subsidising the whole country by giving us a subsidy. So they're not going to gain anything if they wipe it out. They're just going to make it harder and harder for the farmers to survive and anybody in business. So that's what my point is about the thing.
It does sound like, from Tony Wood, who was speaking from the Grattan Institute, that it would take a very brave government or opposition to propose removing the fuel tax rebate, regardless of what the think tank has come out with.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But providing they don't do it. It's being talked about every election. Well, somewhere along the line they may do it, but yeah, like I say, if they want to get rid of all their fuel emissions and everything, put in treadmills on the farm and we can get the unemployment out to tread the mills and we won't have to have diesel motors going to crush grain and feed out the cattle. We can have all electrified things and that they can treadmill to get a generator to charge batteries.
That sounds a bit wild.
Those two things.
Well, thank you for your point, though. Good point there, Anthony. That was Anthony from Bangham, I think it says there. You're listening to the Country Hour. It is 10 to 1.
Give your mum the gift of gardening with a subscription to ABC Gardening Australia and Organic Gardener magazines. Gardening Australia is packed with practical advice, step-by-step instructions, design ideas, and a new, bigger in-the-patch section. An Organic Gardener brings you natural solutions for a healthy harvest and the latest news in sustainable living. ABC Gardening Australia and Organic Gardener magazines. The perfect gift this Mother's Day. Subscribe now at abcmagazines.com.au.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's no secret that health products have been booming for some time, particularly since COVID-19 took over the headlines early last year. In fact, in the United States alone, multivitamins saw double-digit sales, with women's multivitamins up 19% to $474 million. Now, this is a big business, and it's being seen in Australia as well, where a company creating powdered cholera algae grown in ponds just outside of the North Queensland town of Bowen has plans to expand the operation. Now, the Cholera products are enjoying massive popularity on social media channels, where the hashtag has racked up 188 million views, with claims that it's a remedy for a wide range of health concerns, as Tom Major reports.
Pools of bright green water full of the chlorella algae swirl around inside plastic sheeting at the unassuming farm just outside the town of Bowen. The chlorella is an in-demand product when it's dried and processed, and that's leading manager Frank Mason to plan for expansion.
At the moment we're producing with about 3,000 square metres, about 30 kilos per day, but reality is that we have enough capacity to produce 800 kilos per week. We've got enough ponds to do that. Our problem is with the COVID to access machinery to process it. So, yeah, we're sort of hamstrung by that.
The supplement industry has boomed in recent years. In 2020, Complementary Medicines Australia estimated its worth at $3.1 billion with a 6% annual growth rate. It's also a $1 billion export earner, with much product being shipped to China, where industry says demand for Australian products is steadily increasing. But chlorella is part of a wider group of products popular online for their claimed health benefits, with the chlorophyll that provides the deep green colour heavily marketed on social media platforms like Instagram and TikTok, especially as a cure for skin conditions.
It's my first time trying chlorophyll. I just bought this from Whole Foods. I got the mint one. It's the only one I found. Definitely tagged some down below that I should check out, though. This one says to add 15 drops to water 2 to 3 times a day, but I heard the girls saying try 11 because it might make you a little nauseous, so we're doing 11.
Leona Yip is a dermatologist who has analysed the claims of some influencers. She says just don't stack up scientifically.
It's been around for a while, but I think with social media, it's just really taken off because of celebrity hype and also marketing trends. And unfortunately these days, science and credible expert opinions don't seem to matter very much anymore because it's what social media tells us. So chlorophyll's taken off merely because of good marketing on social media.
What are some of the claims being made about chlorophyll?
We know theoretically chlorophyll does have some antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties, but I say this is theoretical because there are extremely limited human studies that have translated this to any meaningful clinical benefit.
Dr. Yip says so far the evidence chlorella supplements will reach the skin are lacking, with concentrations possibly too low to be of benefit.
Chlorophyll itself, we know, contains vitamins A, C, E, K, and some algae contain omega-3, which we know can benefit the skin. However, for meaningful clinical benefits for acne and anti-aging properties, we should look for certain concentrations, minimum concentrations for meaningful benefit. And it's just impossible to tell with these drinks what's in it and whether how much of it actually, or does it actually get to your skin at all.
Accredited practicing dietitian Leanne Elliston agrees there's little evidence yet for chlorophyll products, but she's urging Australians to eat a balanced diet and gain the nutrients they need through fresh food.
Particularly in isolation, I think, is, you know, when you pull things out of food and isolate it, how it works in the body sometimes isn't as effective either. So that's always needs to be considered.
Is there any evidence or ongoing research to support the use of chlorella or chlorophyll supplements?
Look, I think that it's important that this sort of stuff does get researched thoroughly to see if there are any benefits to our health. And I think it's still fairly early days.
Back in Bowen, there's busy times ahead. Once more equipment turns up from overseas, production will increase. But long term, partners will be needed for algae farmer Frank Mason to find the critical ingredient he needs, a source of atmosphere pollution that's largely blamed for climate change.
This is a pilot scale farm, so we are effectively a business startup, but ultimately we need to be attached to a large consumer of basically fossil fuels, such as a coal-fired power station, a gas-fired power station, or a sugar mill, where we can coexist with them and turn their carbon dioxide into algae and basically then use that as a nutraceutical and an animal food, and basically provides a win-win outcome.
It was North Queensland algae farm manager Frank Mason ending that story from Tom Major in the town of Bowen. So up there in far north of Queensland, they're looking at farming chlorella algae. Sounds fascinating. Now, that's almost all we have time for in the program, but a lot of you are wanting to have your say on the fuel tax rebate. Kevin from McGee near Loxton joins me. Good afternoon.
Good day. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Now, what a lot of people are making this point that that farmers don't drive on the road, so that's why they're claiming the rebate. What do you think about it?
Well, the fuel rebate is only the road tax refunded after we pay for it. That's what the rebate is. It's a road tax refunded to us. We have to wait up to 3 months to get that refund back usually when we do our GST. There is nothing to replace a tractor that's got any alternative fuels except cotton oil in some of the older tractors. And why should farmers have to pay a road tax on vehicles they use running around the farm when they're not wear and tear on the roads anyway?
What would it mean if it was taken away from you?
Well, it's about a third of the price of fuel, so that's what it'd put it up. And well, we could survive with it, but I want a bitumen road to the front door. At the moment, we haven't even got a formed road to the front door. We go drive on a track.
Yeah, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
That's a public road, not a track. A public road.
Now, it does sound like this is a pretty hot topic for farmers, and it does seem to crop up around about budget or election time each year.
Yeah, it does, and they better forget it. Like the man said, they want to start thinking again, they're going to start doing that sort of thing. They took a heap of native vegetation off of farmers, so so-called environment. Just leave us alone for a while, will you?
Thanks so much for calling in, Kevin.
Okay, see ya.
That was Kevin at McGee near Loxton. So a lot of you really believe that the fuel tax rebate on the road tax portion of it really needs to stay in place, despite what the Australia Institute was saying earlier in the program. Find out what's coming up on your ABC local radio with Sonia Feldhoff. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. Well, I know whenever we talk about trees, there are many people who are very passionate about them. And particularly here in the city, a lot of people concerned that we're losing trees at far too rapid a rate. Today, the Conservation Council and other groups have let out their action plan to try to turn that one around. So we'll have a look at what you think about that. You can make a decision on whether you think it might make a difference. Also, I don't know, you may not have seen it yet, but you might not be planning to, but maybe you love the idea of Mortal Kombat. South Australia's big film.
I love the idea that there was an Australian in it. I've read the reports.
Well, it was all made here in South Australia. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing, this movie. But what goes on behind a movie like this, especially one that is based on games and characters and things like that? You may never have heard of storyboarding. I certainly haven't. We're going to find out what that all is and why some South Australians have been doing it well with this film.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I actually have heard so much hype about that movie that it's not one I would have normally seen, but I kind of want to see it.
Yeah.
Support South Australian filmmaking.
Exactly.
That was Sonia Fieldoff. She'll have more coming up on your ABC local radio. It's coming up to 1 o'clock, time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.